Good evening, everybody. It's a Wednesday. I know, a Wednesday, another halfway through the week. But I was just telling my guest it's been a blinking long week for me this week. And it was even worse because here where I am in Bristol, in Connecticut, it was the Mum Festival the weekend, so which is what the big festival is. And Thursday, Friday nights, you know, sitting down there where they have all the food trucks and the band, you know, the bands and everything, like lovely evenings because it was lovely weather. But of course Saturday I was there working and it was about 85 degrees, and just where we were in our booth, the sun set in the booth basically. So whereas everybody else was in the shade, we were still in the sun. And then on the Sunday we had the parade. Now the parade had about a couple of hundred floats in it and stuff. It was like 3 hours procession, and it was like over 2 miles, and the temperature was over 90 here in the East Coast in nearly October. It was 90 degrees, but never mind. I am here, and so's my guest. Now, one of the things that I started off with was like a lot of people writing poems to songs, which are basically poems put to words anyway, to music anyway. And then I started short stories, and of course you have my book of short stories, the Bathroom Book of Short Stories, Short Romance Stories. And then even when I wrote my novel, I wrote it in the then lunch hours. Nowadays it's lunch 5 minutes if you're lucky, but the lunch hours, you know, bits of their chapter at a time, like little short stories that went through like that, making it exciting, making it turn, you know, making you want to turn the page. One of the things, if you do are a short story writer, is you have to cram that whole image and story in a small container, so to speak. You have to paint that picture right from the start so that the reader actually grabs onto it, sees what you're doing, and follows it through, wanting to read more. To my mind, it's harder to write a short story than it is a novel, but that's just to my mind. But my guest, she can tell us a bit about this, but I better introduce her first, haven't I? Anyway, I better introduce my guest. I told you I'm tired. I'm all over the place. My guest today, the one and only Caitlin Hamilton Summey. Hi, Caitlin. How are you doing?
I'm wonderful, Barry. How are you?
I'm obviously not right because I'm opening your microphone thinking it's mine, a microphone. But I am here, and you know, I'm here and you're here, which is great because I'm looking forward to chatting to you. First off, obviously, you know, you're into the stories now, but when you were growing up, were you one of these people, as soon as you could hold a crayon, you were writing short little stories and poems and that?
I was. I don't remember it, but my mother does. And she says that before I learned how to shape or write any letters, I'd come to her with these scribbles, really, and ask her to read my stories. And she would say, well, why don't you read them to me?
Yes.
And as a mother now, I think it's a wonderful response. I don't think I would have ever thought of it. But of course, she couldn't read what I'd given her. And I think that response actually typifies my mom and my dad's response from the very beginning to my keen interest in writing. They were always, and still are, supportive.
And I think that's great because it encourages you to use your imagination, because you're the person written the story. And there's no way you'd have been able to read what you wrote, but you knew what you wanted to write because you had that story. So I think that's a great way of teaching the child to use their imagination and to share it.
I think it was, and I think, I don't know if she had such a conscious goal in mind or if she was simply trying to think of some way to keep me going and not embarrass me, you know. I think as a mom now, looking, you know, when I was little, Barry, we had Legos and they were blocks. And now the Legos come with clothes and faces.
Oh my goodness, yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
So there's less of an opportunity for children to imagine. And I think that her encouraging me was wonderful. And I think it's a wonderful point you make. It's something that we parents probably need to work a little harder on in today's world when so much comes prefabricated. They don't need to imagine as much.
It's too right. I mean, you know, we used to play over the fields or the park or, you know, what was there, and you know, it was all imagination. I mean, we build our own, you know, build the forts, and you know, and a bit of fencing was the gun, and you know, and you did this, and you prepared to eat the imaginary meals, and you know, the girls as well, you know, doing the cooking, and I remember my sisters, pick plucking the rose petals from the roses in my mother's front garden and mushing them up with water and then trying to sell them as perfume.
Right. Those are the kinds of things we all used to do.
Yeah.
And I think that fostering that kind of imagination is harder nowadays. But I'm grateful to my mother because I'm sure whether or not she intended it, her encouragement influenced me. I believe she set the stage. She gave me a vocabulary and a space to be creative when I was very young. And I imagine that did fuel me going forward.
And obviously, I guess, you know, that pushed you through into reading a lot when you were younger?
Actually, no. That's
really
such an interesting question. I don't think I read any more or any less than other average children, but I did not start becoming a voracious reader until I was an adult. I wanted to tell the stories more than read them.
See, it's funny. See, I read a lot, but I couldn't spell. In those days before spell check or anything like that.
Right, we didn't have that then either, yes.
Exactly. People used to, my teachers, my mother used to say, but I don't know why spelling's so bad, he reads so much. But I don't know.
That's interesting. I have a friend who reads a lot too, and he also had trouble spelling.
Well, I think if it was these days and I was like that, it would be a mild form of dyslexia. I mean, it's just you weren't diagnosed with that sort of stuff when I was young. I mean, that wasn't what it was, you know. Uh-huh. You're just a bad speller, but if you know what it's in your head, but you can't put it down on paper sort of thing, which is, I guess these days they say, oh, it's a type of dyslexia. That's my view anyway.
I think you're right. Yeah, I think that's...
You did these little stories earlier on, did you sort of carry on writing? Do any of these early stories still exist?
I don't think any of the scribbles exist.
Not the scribbles, but...
but I do actually have a lot of stories. When I was in fifth grade, they had us illustrate and write children's books that we then pinned together, sort of stapled together.
Right.
And I have four or five of those. And I wrote my first novella when I was 13, and I wrote two novels by 18. And
wow.
I have the novella printed out. The novels, I don't think I ever printed out. So they're on one of those big old square floppy disks.
The big old...
I'll never get them back, you know.
No, that's right.
But I have a lot. I've saved a lot.
That's good, because, I mean, we've had, so many famous authors come on the show, and I always say, never throw anything away, Steve Bagley comes on, he had 10 books that were rejected for, no, yeah, 8 books that were rejected for 10 years before anybody picked him up, before people suddenly realised that his sort of action type thing, would sell, and now, of course, he's got 8 million books in print around the world, but out of those 8, which had already been rejected 75 times or something like that, 4 of them were used for the first 4 books, and the other 4 he used bits out of to write some of the other books, and never throw anything away.
You know, that's interesting, because I think that each thing we write is the kind of work that can carry over to the next thing or the next thing or the next thing. But when I was younger, I didn't think that. I don't think I thought as carefully. I think I just wrote. And so some of the things I've saved, I think, are more for nostalgic purposes. But as I've gotten older, I've done what he's done, and I've tried to save drafts because I thought there was something in there I could maybe pull, even though the draft itself wasn't successful. There was an interesting line or an interesting scene, and I saved them and noted them in a file I called extras in case I ever came back to them.
And I think that's great because, it's your creation that's created it. Now, it might be this was just a forewarning of something, a character trying to tell you that they've got a story and you weren't ready for them at the time, or they weren't ready to tell you completely, and then they'll come along later on and say, oh, I started telling you my story about 5 years ago, but, you were a bit busy and I didn't have it worked out. Where is it? I'll tell you the rest of it now. And what?
I love that. I love that because it's true. I think as writers, we all do have these things that sort of pop up in our minds, and we run with them, and we turn them into things. But I love the way you characterize that as somebody or something waiting its turn, sitting there.
Oh yeah. I mean, you ask. I would say 95% of authors, they'll tell you that these characters lead you. You have no chance. You might, no matter how detailed you map everything out there, the characters come along and lead you down different paths. Minor characters want major roles. Some mm-hmm. want their own book, even. You know,
yeah.
We have, I've used this before, this analogy, but a lady came on the show once, and she was quite a well-known historical romance writer. I think it was like her 23rd book she was came on to talk to us about. And we were talking about this thing about, you know, how characters, you know, lead you and change their path and everything. And she was saying that her latest book, this 23rd book, you know, considering she was pretty well-known, she was saying she tried to kill this one character off 7 times and it wouldn't die. She said literally she had to go back and rewrite the book so that the character didn't die.
I think I think that that's a wonderful story, and I think it's the perfect story for what happens.
Yeah, it is. I mean, say majority of the people authors will tell you. When did you finally get round to sort of writing stuff that eventually got published?
Because I started young and I was serious young, I did have some things. Published in high school, I won a competition from a local college. Mm-hmm. So I had some things that were accepted, but there wasn't a lot available to young writers. I think there are more things now. So I guess probably the most serious things that were accepted by anything that mattered began in college and then in graduate school, after which there was a long hiatus because I was working and having children and living my life. But
right.
Yeah, probably I would say the first acceptances were high school.
Okay, great. What finally pushed you to, you know, I guess, you know, life gets in the way, as we all know, of our writing or whatever it is these days. What finally got you to sort of, was it 2017 you started getting some stuff, I know, published in magazines and stuff?
It was 2015, and I think a couple of things happened. One was my dad sort of has this phrase, why not? You know, why not try? And a couple of other things had not worked out well. I'd been working on a middle grade novel and nobody was really interested in it, and I thought, well, I'll let it sit for a while and I'll go back to some of these stories. And I pulled one out and I thought, why not, like Dad says, and I sent it out and it was accepted. And around the same time, well, I guess a little earlier, about a year earlier, a publisher from Fomite named Mark wrote and asked if I had a collection, and I told him I didn't. I really appreciated him taking an interest, but I didn't have a collection. And after that one story was accepted, I thought, well, I should see what I have. And I pulled them out, and I thought I had 10 that were strong enough. And I thought, why not? And so I sent him a note and asked if he was still interested in seeing them. So that's my new mantra, Barry, my new mantra.
Right.
Why not?
Why not? Why not? Right, exactly. So this was the form of your book, To Lay to Rest Our Ghosts?
I'm sorry, I had a little trouble hearing you.
Okay, so this book that you've just brought out, To Lay to Rest Our Ghosts, mm-hmm. is in fact your first book, and it is the collection of short stories.
It is. It's a collection of short stories, and I started them in 1992, and most 8 of them were written between 1992 and 95, maybe not finalized, but written. And then I wrote the last two pretty much from about 2000 to 2015, you know, over a span of 15 years. And it is a collection of short stories, but 3 stories link, and separately 2 stories link.
Now, is there the fact, you know, she had some link and stuff like that, with the title and that, is there sort of a general theme running through it?
I think that in each story, somebody's grappling with something, whether it's a betrayal or a loss. And they need to put this situation or this grief to rest. They need to deal with it so they can get on with their lives. And so I don't think it's something I necessarily saw until I put them all together. But they're all wrestling with something they need to let go of.
Right, as you say, to lay to rest the ghost. Mm-hmm. To get through it, basically.
Mm-hmm.
One of a lot of great reviews people have written on that, and a lot of people say, is about you've got this empathy with the characters. You make it so that people can feel with them. Can you paint the picture great? As I said at the start of the show, you know, in a short story, you have to get that image and that portrayal pretty quickly for the person to grab onto. Is that something that you've always found you're good at doing?
I'm sorry, it's something I've always found easy.
You always found that that comes easily to
comes
you?
Comes easily.
To get, yeah.
I don't know if it comes easily. Some of these stories I've worked on at length. But I think what is true is that I always feel very deeply about these characters. I understand where they are. And with them, to me, comes not just simply that moment, but the history that brought them there. That history, that whole picture, comes easily to me. But pulling it together and taking it from just a story that expresses an emotion into a story where something transformative happens, sometimes that's work.
And as I say, you know, people saying about the sort of images you're able to create with the words, and it covers a lot of things. Somebody in a wheelchair, I think there was, and children in a snowstorm, and you know, different images, but the way you manage to create them, the people can picture it, and in a lot of cases put themselves in the position, I guess.
Oh, I think for me it's very real. You know, somebody asked me at one point, how do you write about male characters, or how do you write about this line of children trying to navigate the snowstorm? And it's simply that I see it. It's very real to me. And their predicaments, I feel keenly. So I guess there's sort of a visceral feeling for me that I am in that snowstorm trying to get the children through. I am that mother roaring into the wind who's so frustrated that the superintendent let the buses go before parents could get to pick up.
Right, and it's not just that. It's what your stories cover. I mean, you're not sort of stuck in sort of certain areas, certain times. I think you go back to World War II, and then you go to, you know, busy cities, and not so nice neighborhood in New York and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. The demographics of what you cover and what you portray covers a wide area.
Well, I think I've been fortunate to live in a lot of different places. And I have, as I start writing and start, like you were saying, things pop up for us as writers. We'll hear a voice or we'll see something. And I think that every place I've lived has touched me in some way. And I come from a multi-generational family as well. So while World War II might be something other children were studying, I'd be sitting on the couch with my grandmother looking at the paper she saved from D-Day. And all of these things sort of, as you say, they sort of wind their way up through the subconscious. So even though I was never a child during World War II, even though that story is fictional, there are things in that story that, you know, my grandmother told me that I know happened to the family, even if it's only one or two moments or two lines. And so I think that's why there's a breadth of setting and a breadth of experience, because I have lived a lot of places with a lot of different generations and different kinds of people.
Right. It's interesting. It seems to be, yeah, you used to be, you know, family tell stories, you know, pass the stories down, or, you know, doing the washing up with your grandmother, mm-hmm. and she used to tell you stories and stuff like that. It seems to be an increase of going back to that, of picking up these stories. People are sort of saying, I should make a note of this. This is going to be forgotten, like you say, World War II and stuff like that. I think people are sort of waking up to the fact that, hey, these stories are going to be forgotten unless we write them down or bring them into a novel or something like that. And it's interesting, over the last 2 or 3 years, I've noticed on the show a lot more of that sort of thing coming
I
through.
think that one of the things that may be happening, and I don't know for a fact, but people are so busy, families are so busy, everyone has a ball practice, everyone has this, that we're now being told how important it is to sit down and eat with our children at night. And we're all online all the time. And I think people have begun to realize, Barry, just like you're saying, that we're losing a lot because we're not writing letters. We're not sitting down and talking as much as we used to. But for me, I think it wasn't necessarily a conscious effort to preserve things. But it has become its own kind of preservation of details from my family. If my children said to me, what in that story about World War II, what were the one or two things that grandma told you, I could point to them.
See, I can remember that. I mean, obviously, I was born not that length of time after end of World War II, and my parents used to. Well, one of the things my parents always used to do was make us sit through World of War on BBC, so we could see the prison camps and stuff like that. So we knew how bad it had been, whereas these days people have no idea. But one of the things I can remember sticking out was the year I was born, candy ration ended
Candy
in England.
rationing, yes.
And also that my parents had never seen a banana until 1958.
Those are incredible details for stories, those kinds of things. Yes. I mean, I think that was what, I guess maybe there are more than two details. It's hard for me to remember, but I remember my grandmother telling me about cheese going on the point system. And that detail,
Yes,
yeah, that
yes.
detail ended up in the story because, my gosh, somebody rationing my cheese,
Yeah. Oh, crikey, yeah. I mean, we had a comedy in England called Dad's Army, which was, basically the sort of Home Guard during the Second War. It's a comedy thing, but the butcher, Mr. Jones the butcher, they were all there with their ration books, seeing how much, whether they got enough points for a sausage this week and stuff like that. I mean, and that's how it was.
And people.
I've saved my points for when so and so comes home, so we can have a real chicken or
And
whatever,
it's incredible to think of now. And you're right. Most people don't know. I mean, I think we've forgotten a lot.
Oh, yeah. The book came out, I think, August, was it? What sort of reception have you received so far from it?
It did. Came out in August. The reviews have been overall really beautiful, very touching. I have no idea how it's selling. I haven't asked for my publisher. But in terms of people's reviews and in terms of our community's response, I've been deeply touched that the stories have touched them.
And because of that, is this driving you to either finish a novel or write another book of short stories?
Well, I'm going to take, I have a draft completed of a novel that includes the three stories that link, the trio. It's very
Right.
rough, needs a lot of work, but I do want that family's stories to get a little bit more space. I'd like to finish the story of their lives.
Pad them out a
Yeah.
bit, right, to a complete story. Well, I know what's been complete, and that is complete pleasure having
I've
you on the
so
show
enjoyed it.
today.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. I'm now, though, going to turn the show over to you so you can tell everybody where they can find out more about you, and of course your book.
Okay. Well, you can find out more about me on my website, CaitlinHamiltonSummy.com. That's CaitlinHamiltonSummy, MIE, CaitlinHamiltonSummy.com, and my book is available at selected independent bookshops nationwide and also through Amazon and Smashwords and all the online vendors.
That's great. Well, Caitlin, thank you so much for being a guest on the day.
Thank you.
It's been a great pleasure having you. And perhaps when your novel comes out, you'll come back and chat to us
again. I would love to. Thank you so much, Barry.
My pleasure. Thank you. Well, there you go. My guest today, Caitlin Hamilton Sammy, Caitlin Hamilton, Hamilton, and Sammy is Summie. Been talking about her book of short stories, great little short stories, and you should, some of the reviews tell you exactly what they think of it. Wonderful painting of words, making you be there in these short stories, feel the snow hitting you in the face and stuff like that. And her book is To Lay to Rest Our Ghosts, a collection of short stories. Well, that's it for now. I will be back on Sunday, but until then, as always, we have one thing left to say. Don't forget...